Good morning from Croom on the banks of the Maig, where I'm looking right now at two dogs having the best morning ever in a river, just retrieving a stick. You might think that you don't know the Maig. It's not one of our more celebrated rivers, but if you've ever stopped for a while to look at the picture postcard settings in places like Adair or Brewery or Croom or Kilmallock, you do know the Maig and its tributaries. Now, some of this programme is not going to make for easy listening as we take a look at what it is that we have done to this river, to the damage and to the places where it is struggling. But once you look closely at a river, it's also very hard not to see things to celebrate. Recovery, regeneration and the people of a community making a real difference to their own environment.
My name is Catherine Dalton. I'm a lecturer in geography in Mary Immaculate College in Limerick. I am the current chair of the Maig Rivers Trust. We were established initially because there was a big pollution incident on the upper reaches of the catchment in the Luba River. There was a big slurry discharge into the river and it killed thousands of fish. And there was a real groundswell of support that we must look after our rivers. So it was formed with that in mind from a range of people with different interests in the rivers. Farmers who are concerned about the rivers, community-centred people working with tidy towns, other people who were interested in recreation.
So the anglers, the canoeists, the paddlers.
Exactly. And myself, I was very interested in the river from a research perspective, giving opportunities for my students to do projects and to do placement experiences.
Describe the catchment of the Maig to me.
Okay, the Maig covers about 1,000 square kilometres from the upper headwater rivers in the Ballyhauras, and the waters then accumulate together into the Maig River, which discharges into the Shannon Estuary.
How many kilometres of river?
So about 1,200 kilometres worth of streams and river in length.
The Ballyhaura Mountains would be pretty much the only upland area in the catchment then, would it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few other hills that kind of circle the catchment, but basically the Maig occupies the Limerick Basin, which is the lowland area of about a third of the county of Limerick.
So predominantly flat, predominantly agriculture, not an awful lot of forestry, is there?
No, only bits of forestry up in the Ballyhauras.
How is the health of the river?
I'm afraid the river is not in great shape. The last EPA reports suggest that the river is more than 30% in poor condition, almost 40% in moderate condition, which is still not great, and just over 20% in good condition. Good being the almost okay, but we have no pristine top-class waters in the Maig River catchment.
So no pristine waters, and 70% of the waters are less than good.
Yes, agriculture, I'm afraid, is the dominant cause.
I met Catherine in Croom on a sunny, sleepy day. Scores of people were out using the village's 17 acres of park on the banks of the river. It's the kind of amenity that every village would give its eye teeth for. But the east bank of the river is also a good example of how we have imposed our ideas of what nature should look like upon nature itself. I would call this a riverbank. I assume, because you're a scientist, you would think of this as a riparian border.
Quite a manipulated riparian border, I'm afraid.
Okay.
If we look to the opposite side of the river, the riparian, the vegetation, the trees, the scrub, the bushes, the hawthorn, the native species, that's a lovely riparian border.
That tangle of roots reaching down into the water, what job is that doing?
So the roots really are helping stabilise a bank. So the river here obviously is higher in winter and it's much lower at the moment on this nice summer, or spring day, I should say. Mm. But the Yeah, so the roots really act to stabilise all that bankside.
So when we have floodwaters ripping through here, that will prevent the bank being eroded, will it?
Yeah, less erosion will happen there compared to this side, which has been modified and straightened probably at some point.
So if you had to choose a bank in time of flood to stand on, it would be that one on the far side.
Absolutely. So we did a study of the riparian across the catchment. We got leader funding for it. And they concluded that more than 60% of the catchment has lost its riparian. It's in either very bad or poor condition.
Radio Éireann. A Munster Journal, a weekly digest of events in the Southern Province, edited and presented by Andreas O'Gallagher.
This month, 63 years ago, the grandfather of Countrywide and RT Radio broadcast this item of news from the village of Croom.
And from hurling among the Irish in New York to the quieter sport, or should we say vocation, of fishing. The man of the moment in this sphere is Mr. John Moyland of Croom, County Limerick. For at the weekend, he hooked and landed the biggest salmon caught in the River Mag for over 45 years. The salmon, which was caught with a blue Devon, weighed 35 pounds. And with thoughts...
In 2025, nobody is allowed to fish the Mag for salmon any longer. They're in such danger. There is another inhabitant of the Mag that tells you a lot about what is going on in the water, a tiny little crustacean known in Irish as Angliamach Fuinisce, the freshwater lobster. This white-clawed crayfish has all but disappeared in many European rivers, but it is still clinging on here, just about. A few kilometres downstream of Croom, in Brewery, Ella McSweeney met Bogna Griffin, a freshwater scientist from the Marine Institute who has been surveying crayfish on the Mag using the latest DNA technology since 2018.
Yeah, so we have all our equipment now together. Bucket full of stuff and the pump. And we're going to go down the river, down to the riverbank. To take our samples.
What are you testing? Mm-hmm. What is the theatre ground, is it?
Countrywide. We're doing a programme for Radio 1 on the River Mag.
Oh, lovely.
And Bogna very kindly has agreed to talk a little bit about the crayfish. She's from the Marine Institute.
Okay, right, very good.
Yeah.
So we test the water here for crayfish and crayfish plague. So there used to be a lot of crayfish in the Mag.
Right.
And a few years ago, they started dying out, yes.
I do a bit of fishing, but trout are very scarce, even like trout. And there's no salmon now, like.
There doesn't seem to be much in the river at the moment. No.
Can I ask what your name is?
Mike Maloney.
Are you living...
I'm just living there, yeah.
Oh, right beside the river.
Right inside the river, like such, you know.
What are your memories of the river when you were younger?
There was great fishing at that time. Great fishing, trout, salmon, whatever. You could go out there in the evening and cast away, and for an hour, you might come home 5 or 6 trout, like, you know. You go now, like, you might be lucky if you come home with one. Even at that, like, you know, you'll be lucky, like, and such, you know.
And when you look at it, does it look different?
The colour, like, colour, you know, it's not a clear colour, like a salmon, sure. You know, it's just quality of the water, not the best, like, and such, you know.
What does the river bring to you?
Peace and quiet. I mean, if someone's even going down there, do a bit of fishing, like, not a worry in the world, like, and such, you know. You know, which is mighty, like, in fairness, you know. It's a lovely setting, like, and such, like, you know. It's for a river to flow through a village, like, you know, it's a lovely thing to have, and such, you know.
Very lucky. You know, and there was salmon here.
Oh, there was, plentiful one time, you know, plentiful. But they don't seem to be coming there at all now, in fairness, you know. They meet a lot of obstacles on the way up along the river as well, like, you know. So, you know.
Would you like to see the river restored?
Oh, God, I would, yeah, definitely. So, like, you know, it's a great amenity to have, like, such, you know. Not from just local, but I mean, probably bringing a few tourists around the place as well, such, you know. You know, just the quality of the water is the problem, such, like, you know.
So I'm just going to take the tubing out and feed it through the pump. So the fragments of DNA that are in the water actually get trapped in the filter. When we go back to the lab, we can extract all those bits of DNA from the filter.
While you're doing that, I'm just looking at the river, my first sort of close-up view of it. have to say, it does not look healthy, Bognor. The base of it is covered in what looks like debris and scum and green vegetation.
There's a lot of sediment. There's a lot of sedimentation in there. Now, this hasn't been the case, I must say. I've been coming here since 2019, and this spot used to be one of my favorites, with beautiful, exposed, big rocks and nice little pebbles, which are probably, you know, the best habitat for crayfish. But in the last 5 years, it has changed a lot.
If this was a pristine river, at the top level, what would we be looking at?
We would be looking at clear water running over stones, not covered in algae or sediment. You should be able to see gravel, you should be able to see some pebbles, you should be able to see fish flying up and down the river.
There's nothing there?
Not that I can see, unfortunately, no. And it is one of my favorite spots, I must say. It used to be beautiful. So I just fed the tubing through the pump, so I'm just going to throw it in.
In it goes. So the pump goes on, it's sucking water in. In it goes, it's flowing into the bottle now.
It's flowing into the bottle at the moment.
You've been surveying the River Maig for crayfish. What have you found?
In 2018, when the program started, there was plenty of detection of crayfish in all our sites and the tributaries, and we detected crayfish in most of those places. Now, unfortunately, in 2019, we had an outbreak of crayfish plague, which is a water mold that's affecting the crayfish at the moment. The plague spread upstream through the main channel upstream to the tributaries as well. So local people were finding hundreds and thousands of dead crayfish on the riverbank. So in 2023, we asked an ecologist to come out with us to sample the river. So I've taken environmental DNA samples, and he actually went into the river, turned stones over, and sadly, neither of us found crayfish.
So have they gone extinct?
Possibly. The hope is that the crayfish may come back. The only problem is if the water quality is not good enough, the plague is the least of their problems in that case. If they are to come back, they need to come back to a nice habitat, which isn't here anymore.
So the motivation there is to clean the river?
The motivation there is to provide the best habitat possible for the crayfish and other animals, basically. I met this lovely farmer in the Maig. He was telling me how the crayfish have disappeared from the river. And he was telling me that now he finds otters that visibly turn the stones over looking for crayfish, and they're no longer there. So they're starting to eat juvenile fish. So that disturbs the whole ecosystem. So basically the fish can't grow because they're being eaten. It's all connected.
And it can all feel very hopeless and very negative and very sad. But I suppose there is an important message here that is so clear from evidence, from examples, where river restoration, when it happens, it can work. Life can be brought back to these rivers.
That's correct. And there is always hope. You know, you can see the spread of the plague all over the country. I know that there are examples in several countries where they started captive breeding and reintroducing the crayfish into the rivers to bring them back.
Yes. And it's worked?
It has worked, yes. Yeah. Yes, it has worked. And also crayfish in some places are building up immunity to the plague, so they can live happily with the plague. Before we talk about reintroduction of protected species, reintroduction of anything else, we need to look at the habitats that we're bringing them into. You know, that they're still there for them.
...1,200 kilometres of river in the Maig catchment. 70% of the water is in poor or just moderate condition. No salmon fishing allowed. 60% of the natural riverbank lost or remodelled, with serious impacts on other wildlife. Much of that impact coming from the dairy industry. That's the bad news. But the whole picture is much more nuanced. Large corporations have made a lot of money from dairy. So too, though, have many people who, 40 years ago, might only have emigrated.
Yeah, you can always milk here, but then, of course, you have a certain amount of farmers that will have dry stock as well, you know.
Charleville, with a population of 4,000, is one of the bigger and busier towns in the Meigg catchment. Auctioneer Billy Biggin gave me a tour of what he calls the town that milk built.
As well as milk and cows, but...
Would there have been anything else other than milk?
Oh, no, milk was the thing.
The once Golden Vale, now Kerry Group factory, dominates the skyline of the town and the jobs market too.
So how many would there be here now?
I don't think there's only maybe 250 or 300 there now.
That's still fairly considerable employment in a town of this size though, isn't it?
It is.
Once you start looking at Charleville through the lens of how every activity is related to milk, then you see it everywhere. Every second van creeping through Charleville's never-ending traffic nightmare says farm supplies, tractor repair, bulk tank maintenance, silage contractors, slurry contractors, and so on. One of the more surprising spin-off industries is the number of engineering firms all making large stainless steel tanks.
And the stainless steel industry started with Golden Vale. Golden Vale had they had the most modern engineering workshop in Europe.
And so how did that work then? People got their training in Golden Vale engineering and then set up in private business?
Started their own business then. There'd be six or seven of them anyway.
And how big businesses are these? I mean, are they two or three people, or are they 15, 20 people?
Well, we passed there now, there'd be maybe 200 in each place there, like, you know.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. All right.
I'll show you a small one down here now, that just after opening in the last few months.
And without all of that, do you think it would be quite a depressed place?
Sure, but of course, you know, if we didn't have that industry in town, it would be a very depressed place.
Oh, Sloane is killed.
The Meigg has always brought wealth. The contractors, the engineers, the merchants and suppliers of Charleville are the modern-day iteration of what 18th-century songwriter Andreas McCraith described in his song Sloane le Meigg. He was forced out of the parish by a priest who disapproved of his womanising, and he lamented losing the estates, the jewels, the craftsmen, the crowds, the arts, the stories, the good-humoured warriors. We're in McAuliffe's interpretation of Andreas McCraith's Sloane le Meigg. Coming up after the break, the modern day warriors of the River Meigg.
God's hand gone short, God's sport, God's been.
Countrywide@rte.ie.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, we are devoting this morning's programme to the story of one river catchment, the Meigg in Limerick. The Morning Star River, one of the Meigg's biggest tributaries, flows through the middle of John McNamara's dairy farm.
Each cow has four teats, so there is four clusters. So we can go four at a time, there's no need to go once. Make sure you put your thumb in, that you will hear us.
In his parlour, John is persuading a school tour from Newcastle West National School to stick their thumbs into a milking cluster to see how a cow's teat is massaged to get the milk out.
Can you get the vacuum the way it pulls in and out? Can you get the vacuum?
I thought it would suck in. Open-mouthed awe all around at the revelation that this is where milk comes from.
Oh, sure, my favourites, Philip, are like that, you know, the milk is hot, like, how is the milk hot? You know, and I have 10.
It doesn't come out of the cow chilled. That's the biggest surprise.
And I have 10 maybe or 20 open mouths looking at me where they just can't understand, you know. You know, Philip can't believe that they could sit down on the cubicle mash, you know, and call it the cow's bed that the cow laid on maybe, you know, less than 2 weeks ago.
Well, you do have the most insanely clean cubicles that I have ever seen on any dairy farm ever.
Yeah, I don't know, would I go that far, Philip, and saying
I would.
I think we have a...
John McNamara is driven, progressive and energetic, a whirlwind in the form of a farmer. You have never seen a farm like this. Pristine parlour, immaculately clean cow cubicles that you could eat your dinner off, new hedgerows planted around his paddocks, and increasing amounts of space for nature along the banks of the Morningstar.
How big or how challenging was the problem of water quality here?
I suppose it's crucial to us now that, you know, that we mind it and we protect it. And I suppose we feel now that, you know, more so than ever before, that now it has something to add to the farm. It adds an amenity. It certainly adds, I suppose, you know, now we have an area where we can bring school children, where we can bring groups and show that... you know, the rivers, you know, they need to be protected. You know, there's fish in it, there's habitats in it. You know, you've plants on left and right of it. And I suppose, look, we've tried to do our bit as well then to enhance the river.
What have you done?
We've planted whitethorn hedging as a buffer along the river. Also, I suppose, the OPW have been on and they've put some weirs in places. And it's always nice to see the weirs where you get the splash of water. And my understanding of that is that it allows oxygen to the fish as well. So I think that's always very good to see. And it's nice when we look in at the minute, Philip, just as we look in at the water, we can nearly see our reflection coming back to us, which is really good to see.
Do you know what's the first thing that you kind of notice about your river and your farm is that, untypically, it still has lots of bends and curves to it. Nobody ever came along and channelized it and made it all go in a straight line.
No, and I think it probably would be disappointing if that ever happened, Philip, because I think the reason the bends are in, and my understanding again would be that it slows the water down. But it's a lovely feature to the river as well in the way that it has the bends. Certainly, you know, with a drone shot or an aerial shot at the minute, it looks really nice with the white thorn hedges on the outside all around. And, you know, just on our land alone, we probably have 8 to 10 bends as the river flows through the farm.
Monitoring of the river's water quality by the EPA as it flows through John's farm shows that it is good, which shows that you can have intensive farming and good river water quality side by side. But this happened mostly because John wanted it to. He isn't in the department's environment scheme, Acres. Too much paperwork for too little reward, in his opinion.
You know, once we obey the rules and regulations that we have there, where we do our spreading widths and our time zones and all that, there's no reason why that we can't operate a grass-based system and still have the water quality really good.
Lovely hedging. I'd say this white thorn is going to be an absolute riot of colour in a few weeks' time.
Yes, that's really developing at the moment, I suppose, Philip, and you're probably in the peak season for white thorn at the moment as well. I suppose, look, we're doing it for two reasons as well. We're using it as a buffer and we're using it maybe to add to the biodiversity on the farm. Also, look, we have the bridge over it. Also, I suppose, just the other things that we've done
is... there was no hedging here before. You put all of this in at your own expense.
Yes, that's quite true, Philip. Obviously, over different years or whatever, so some of it is more in an advanced stage now, the more of it, but it will all get there eventually. Also, I suppose, we've a lot of clover put back into the paddocks now at the moment as well. And also, all slurry...
Look at him.
Yes.
Big brown trout.
Yes.
You see him?
Yes, I do. Seems to be certainly heading upstream anyway, Philip.
That's a plant. You put him in there. Somebody released him upstream, did they, for my benefit?
I don't think so, Philip. I'm not too sure. Not too many knew you were coming today. So, but certainly really good to see. Really good to see.
John McNamara's farm is a roadmap to restoring rivers while still milking cows. But the amount of his own money that John has spent to achieve that also shows how much investment is needed for others to reach the same standard. What part is the hugely profitable dairy industry playing in supporting farmers to make that change?
I'm Pat Murphy. I'm the CEO of Kerry Dairy Ireland. We're a business, 1.4 billion turnover last year. We have 2,800 milk suppliers and we have 1,600 employees, so I look after that business today.
Kerry Dairy Ireland is the main processor of milk in the Maig River catchment. It has done business here first as Golden Vale and now as Kerry since that 34-pound salmon was caught in the Maig over 60 years ago.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's for sure a concern, and there's a lot of different pressures that have made the water quality in the River Maig what it is today. It's not just agricultural emissions.
No, it's not. It absolutely isn't. But agriculture is number one, and it is head and shoulders number one above all of the other sources.
And I think that, I suppose, at this stage, the farmers along the River Maig and all other rivers in the Kerry catchment area are now knuckling down to what we have to do over the next number of years to make sure that we curtail any of the sources of pollution that might be coming from farms.
What do you say to the people who ask you, though? Why did you let it get this bad?
I mean, I don't think it's as bleak as that. Like, you know, I think that there's been a lot of intensification of dairying over the last 10 years since quotas were lifted. Maybe we expanded too rapidly. But at this stage, we are where we are. I mean, we haven't seen a huge expansion of milk over the last couple of years. So I think that farmers are now, you know, that we realise at this stage that we have to get water quality better.
But farmers need support in doing that, Pat. What are you doing to help them?
So I suppose that's a good question. I suppose we have up to 10 people in Kerry Agribusiness now fully dedicated to water quality and helping farmers to understand what they have to do at farm level. So they get visits from Kerry Agribusiness, a technical expert, and agree a number of corrective actions that they can do on their farm.
But all of that has to be funded. And what are you doing as a company that, you know, had a turnover of over $1 billion last year and profits of 39 million and increased yield of 1.6%? What are you doing to support farmers in that regard?
So we now incentivize farmers to do those corrective actions on their farm to try and prevent any drain off of effluent into any local water stream. So now they get paid by the EIP program, but also by Kerry Agribusiness to get those corrective actions done and then to come back to us after 12 months and give us proof that's done.
But right, there's only, what, 250 farms in the EIP?
Yes, there's of our 2,500 or maybe 2,800 farmers, 250 currently are in the EIP programme.
10% of farms are being incentivised to do something?
No, that's not correct now, because our Evolve programme that was launched 3 years ago, which has incentives in place, over 95% of our farmers are involved in the Evolve programme, which is doing corrective actions or doing actions on their farm to improve their carbon emissions or to improve their water quality or to improve their solids that they get from their cows, whatever mixed solids they get from their cows. So,
if it was working, wouldn't we be seeing better water quality results?
And in fairness, we met the EPA there recently, Philip, and they tell us that that for the first time, maybe in a long time, that water quality in specific rivers and water courses in Ireland are getting better in 2024. So I think now we're seeing the progress of the actions that were put in place over the last number of years.
Wouldn't it have been better that it had never gotten to this state, though?
I think we are where we are today. I think over the last couple of years, I think that we realised that we have to fix what's not working. And I think that farmers across the country, there are 17,000 dairy farmers in Ireland at this stage, the vast majority of those are absolutely committed to getting water quality right on their farms, and we can see that, like, with the engagement that we're getting in Kerry Agribusiness.
Can the industry afford to support farmers to the extent, though, of a long-term payment for sustainability, not just once-off grants for introducing certain changes around the farm, but something that incentivizes them in that they know 10, 20, 30 years from now they will be rewarded for doing the things that improve water quality. Can the industry do that?
Oh, I think it's part of the meat payment these days, like, you know, so that in this year it'll cost us about 10 million euros in terms of, it's about a centilitre that we'll give to farmers this year to make sure that their carbon footprint, their water quality, their genetics is best in class on their farms. Like, so there has to be long-term payment for what they're doing on the farms, like, you know. So this is not just a short-term once-off. It's there indefinitely, like, yeah.
But that is split amongst a number of different kind of improvements. Just specifically on the water quality, I mean, given that that decision on the derogations retention is really effectively months away now, should this not be all shoulders to the wheel?
I mean, I think the EIP programme is a massive boost to farmers over the last couple of years. It's 50 million to Irish farmers.
To 250 farms.
Well, no, that's just to Kerry farmers, but
yeah,
it's
in
open.
In your business, oh, 250 farms.
Sure, and we focus, first of all, on the rivers that have priority action. So some of our rivers in the catchment are maybe more polluted than the rest of them.
How worried are you that farming is at a point on issues like water quality of losing its social license, of losing support, of the public just turning around and saying, sorry, this is a polluting industry, it has to stop?
I wouldn't accept that at all. Like, I mean, I think that in general, farmers are considered to be pillars of society in Ireland. Like, you know, that they do a fantastic job. It's not an easy job. It's 7 days a week for dairy farmers. It's across the year. So I think that forever in Ireland, I think we acknowledge what our farmers do for us, our dairy farmers, all our beef farmers, tillage farmers. I think we'll never lose that social license. I think that we have to do better into the future. We have to get things like water quality right. But what we see from the EIP programme and other programmes in place, I think that we're going the right direction and it's onwards and upwards.
The Maig is an everyman river. Its story is the same as most others in the south of the country. It will take more and more resources from profitable industries to help restore it, and it will take communities getting ever more involved in driving that change.
What do you think that is?
Eel.
An eel. It is an eel. And did you know they're all born in America? And they live here for about 9 years. Now, this is only a baby one, all right?
I think that little girl's going to drink it.
Oh, I hope not. All right.
I'm Brenda Donoghue, and I'm here in the bandstand in Adairtown Park by the River May. And as you can hear, I'm surrounded by some young, enthusiastic explorers on this family river session led by Jeff Hunt.
Hi, it's great to see such a crowd here learning about the food cycle of a river and also the mini beasts that are in the park itself.
We already know a bit of the animals.
That's really cool.
We're going to find worms.
Okay. Yeah, we are going to find worms.
What if we find something dangerous?
Oh, well, if you find something dangerous, you can show me and I'll tell you if it's going to bite you or not. All right, I want everyone to take a spoon and a container and I want you to go off and I want you to see if you can find something and we'll see who can be the first one to find something. And you can show me.
Quick, have a good look.
Now you can dig the soil with the spoon and see if you can find something. Ah, look, there's a worm.
I found a worm. I found a worm. Oh my God, it's a really cute worm.
I just love it when the children can tell me what they found.
Just looking at your lovely hat, the Heritage Council, it says in it, and heritage in schools.
Yeah.
You love working with children, you love teaching. Tell me a little bit about that, Jeff.
Yeah, it's actually, I got my interest in wildlife originally from my father. I started as a bird watcher, and a lot of bird watchers, then you've seen what's local and then you notice that they feed on insects. So butterflies are colourful, you're bound to find butterflies when you're out bird watching. All right, so then one thing leads to another, and I've become broad based. I've been lucky, I've met people along the way that have opened doors for me.
This is visiting schools?
Yeah, for the heritage in schools. I've been 20 years doing it. Do you know what that is?
A wood louse.
It is, shake my hand. Oh, it's a wood louse. It's not an insect because it has more than six legs. It's called a crustacean.
Yeah.
All right, so I'll put the lid on so it won't escape. That's it.
This river here, you love it, don't you?
Yeah, well, it's got such easy access, that's why. When you've a public park, children can explore it. And it's shallow. And when you first look at it, you'd swear there's not much there. But when you put your net in, you find things. And I'm finding things every year. There's something different. It's never exactly the same from one year to the next.
Now, there are a queue of young people here, all with their finds and their catches. Can we go through it? Hi, what's your name?
My name is Eve.
Now, what have you got there? Do
I've
you
got
know?
I've got this, like, animal, and I don't know what it is. It looks like a piece of moss.
Yeah, can you see it's got legs?
I think it's a centipede.
And it is a centipede. Shake my hand.
What's your name?
Bobby.
You've got a few containers, Bobby. Yeah, so what have you got in this one, do you think?
I found a huge worm.
You certainly did. He's a whopper.
I found a little one.
Do you know those happy thingies called...
The pond skaters?
Yeah, they hop around so high.
Oh, did they jump out?
Hello, boys. I know you're doing this through Gaelga. How the four shift in you?
For me, Kiro.
August?
August Pish.
How the four Tosa?
Nothing.
You found nothing?
Nifos. Nifos. Oh. For two woodlouse. Not four. Aber four, bae.
Woodlouse.
Oh,
surely everybody must be nearly finished hunting at this stage.
Yeah.
Did you learn anything? What's your name?
My name is Annabelle.
Yeah.
And Jeff told me that centipedes it's like antennas coming out of their heads, that they can smell their food. And I didn't know that before.
I loved it because you can find new animals and worms and new species of different types of animals that lives under dirt.
Well, look. Keep hunting.
I've just collected some stuff from the river, and in my tray I managed to find an eel. And I've also got a water beetle. The star of the show for me is this one here, which is the damselfly. It's the first one that I've seen this year. They live in the water for 2 years, and then they climb out and might only fly for about 12 days. And then that's their life cycle. But before they die, they'll lay some eggs.
Jeff, final thing. We have some still hunting. It looks like they're there for a long haul.
Yes. For the night, yeah. It's just magic, isn't it? We're so disconnected from our natural environment with screens. It's all screens these days. I just wish more people would take notice of what's around them, especially when it comes to creeper crawlies and insects.
There's torpedoes in the water.
Now, we do need to put it back where we found it.
To finish up this morning, I want to circle back to that piece of music that we played a snatch of earlier, Farewell to the Maig, but this time from a local woman, Siobhan Ní Conaran, who grew up and farms quite close to the river. You'll remember the backstory to this 18th century lament. The poet has been banished by the parish priest for his womanizing, and he explores his grief in verse, and in a way that over 250 years later still moves those living along the Maig, as Siobhan explains.
O slán is céad an daobh seo uaim, cos mai na gair, na gréibh, na gruach, na stát, na séad, na fair, na slua, na mnán, na nreacht, na dréan gan huaim. He remembers the maig, the berries, the stacks, the bank of the river. He also remembers Nasluwa, the crowds of people that he had met. Nanon, the poetry, those who wrote the stories, Nanreacht. And then what he refers to as the warriors, the free-hearted warriors who most likely were some of his own in the court of Féileacht, people of open-mindedness, a certain level of rebelliousness, a certain level of strength. And he goes on then to say, Och, ochon is broi to misha, gan chid, gan chor, gan coip, gan kiste, gan salt, gan shod, gan sport, gan spiona, o sholoch me, chun uignish. He's talking about sailing into his own loneliness, what he's leaving behind. Ochon is broi to misha, I am heartbroken, and that sense of sheer heartbreak as he leaves it behind is once again expressed. This tune has a particular place for me because it is, of course, the parish in which I was born, and it's linked to a river that was in the town in which I was educated, where you shopped, where you knew everybody. But also it was about what you learnt about the river and about the parish in school. And if I might say, there was a group of people in Croom all those years ago. They were very connected to the Irish language and they were connected to local history. From them, I learnt about it, and I also had a value of place, language, culture and history. So what was most important was it brought me on my own personal journey, whereby I ended up with a real love for the Irish language, for history, and indeed my overall involvement now in music and Irish culture through Cultus Cultori Éireann.
That's our programme this week. I hope you enjoyed it. This is Siobhán Ní Chonaireann with Farewell to the Maig. Good morning.